from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Class has always been described as America's dirty secret. What is the real nature of the social class divide in America? And are the rich, as Scott Fitzgerald once said to Ernest Hemingway, really different than the rest of us? New studies out of University of California, San Francisco suggest that they are, and that those in the lower class are actually more concerned about the needs of others, more empathic, more helpful, and more charitable. We hear all about the studies in the hour ahead, which will include your calls, emails, and your online questions and comments after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to the second hour of this morning's forum program. How much does social class affect or even determine social behavior? Well, ongoing researchers out of the University of California, San Francisco and UC Berkeley have been grappling with questions related to social class differences and publishing findings in premier journals such as Psychological Science and the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology. Two of those researchers are joining us in studio for this forum hour to tell us what they found and how they found it. Thacker Keltner is professor of psychology and co-founder and faculty director of the Greater Good Science Center at UC Berkeley and also author of Born to be Good, The Science of a Meaningful Life. And he joins us in studio. Welcome.
It's great to be here, Michael.
Good to have you. Michael Krauss also here with us, postdoctoral fellow in health psychology, University of California, San Francisco. And welcome to you. Good morning.
Good morning.
Glad to have you both. And Thacker, let me begin with you. Let's talk about the methodology. I mean, you sort of separate people based on their education, based on their income, all of those kinds of things that determine socioeconomic class. And where do we go from there? We go to photographs, videos, ladders. I mean, tell us about the methodology.
Right. Well, you know, the first question is how do we really measure and conceptualize a person's social class? And people have thought about this in many different ways. And right now we're using a couple of different methodologies. And one is to put together measures of people's income and the prestige of their occupations and then their educational background. And that gives you what the field thinks of as a materialistic or objective sense of social class. And then secondly, what's equally important we're finding in our research is your own personal subjective sense of your social rank. And so all we do with that is we have people indicate on a 10-run rung ladder where their social class is vis-a-vis other people. So starting there, we get people's sense of social rank, and then we turn to the effects that we're interested in. And in the particular study you're talking about, we're really interested in, can people from lower class backgrounds judge emotions better? And so we've presented them with facial expressions of emotion and had them judge the emotion. We present them with photos of people expressing emotion in the eyes and look at the effects there, and we're demonstrating really striking effects.
It seems to be demonstrating dramatically that people who have less give more, or they're more generous. In fact, there are a lot of studies that seem to buttress what you've come to, that they're more charitable as well. They give a higher proportion of their income than people of so-called upper class.
Yeah, it's really remarkable. Using these methodologies of measuring social class, we find people from lower socioeconomic backgrounds give more of their income. They believe that it's better to give more of their income. If you give them a resource in a laboratory study and you ask them to give money to a stranger, they give more of the money to a stranger. No matter how you study altruism and compassion, people from lower class backgrounds are more generous, even though they have less.
So, Michael Krauss, you're looking at the head nods and eyebrow raising and laughs and all those kinds of things, and essentially determining that there's less responsiveness and reactiveness in those of the so-called upper class echelon. They're more impolite, in fact, to strangers, aren't they, generally?
That's right. In a study where we looked at the first 60 seconds of interactions between strangers, people of lower class backgrounds, lower income, lower education status, tended to be more polite. So more head nodding, more eyebrow flashes. These are expressions that show interest and involvement in interactions. In contrast, upper-class individuals were more likely to be disengaged and more impolite in their interactions. The best example, I think, is they were checking their cell phones, going into their book bags and the like during those interactions.
Less empathy is, I think, what it boils down to, and maybe more rude and insensitive in their behavior because, What, because they're less dependent on others?
Yeah, that's what we think. We think it's really about not needing other people. When you have a lot of resources, when you have access to institutions, when you have power in social settings, you just don't need to rely on people as much. And as a result, you really can foster your own sort of individual self rather than worrying about what other people are feeling and thinking.
Less of a threat, in other words, to people of more substantial income or more status in what they do or more higher rank or whatever you want to call it.
Right. That's right.
But how do you prove something like compassion? How do you show, for example, that one group is more compassionate than the other?
Well, this is the age-old question of measurement, and we approach the study of compassion from multiple perspectives, and we measure people's reports of feelings. We measure their, like Michael described, their social behavior. Are they leaning forward and showing empathic concern? We can get down to physiology and measure a branch of the nerves we call the vagus nerve to look at, which is implicated in feelings of compassion. And on all these measures, we're finding that lower class individuals just feel more compassion in response to the plight of others.
And are more egalitarian.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that seems to be a very important part of the psychology of class.
So it's almost counterintuitive because people with fewer resources and fewer opportunities and less access to, better social institutions or whatever you would think would maybe have more of a grudge, more resentment, those kinds of things.
Yeah, and that's what's striking to us, which is that you could make the argument that if you have less, you're going to be fundamentally oriented toward protecting the self and being selfish at your core, and we're finding just the opposite. So counterintuitive.
Michael, the lower class, it's funny to use these kind of terms. I must recoil a little bit when I do, but what we're calling the lower socioeconomic class of people here, or at least who've come up to those criteria, they're also different in just the way they respond socially. We're talking about social interaction largely here, aren't we?
That's right. Even in the briefest social interaction, so the first 15 seconds where people are meeting each other, we're seeing these types of effects.
And actually, you get into some cultural anthropology here too. A lot of this sounds like sociology and psychology, but I was reading the work you've done, and they were talking about a group in Peru and versus a more highly competitive group in Indonesia. Run that down for us, because that's kind of fascinating stuff.
Right. So it's individuals from cultures who are more resource dependent on each other tend to be more cooperative, so tend to share resources more.
Dependence again increases generosity.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. That's what we find in cultural research, and it's also what you is sort of rooted in our basic attachments to our parents, for example. When you're really dependent on your parents, and your mom leaves the room, for example, and then returns, there's this wonderful togetherness reunion that happens between infants and parents. And so you find that even in the developmental literature with young children.
This is, Decker, pretty hierarchical stuff and rank stuff too. I mean, a lot of people can say, are we getting too, ingrained with the idea that these are rigid categories? But actually, you actually did a lot of follow-up where you had people imagine themselves in a lesser position and it showed more empathy as a result.
Right. So we root our thinking about the effects of social class in this emergent literature on rank and power and hierarchy. And what we know across really the primates and mammalian species is that if you're a lower rank individual and in a hierarchy, you, as Michael's been saying, you tend to be more dependent on others. You tend to orient very carefully and vigilantly to other people to navigate the environment. And that helps us understand this upside, if you will, to lower socioeconomic background, which is dependent and vigilant to others. They show greater empathic concern and greater compassion.
Do you know Bob Fuller's work? Bob, I think actually he revealed it on this program before. He was a former president of Oberlin College and did a whole book on rank.
Uh-huh.
And how people respond to higher rank or somebody not having a status position or not having a status of education and so forth. It's very pervasive, as one might suspect and glean from our culture. He's done some good work. I just wondered if there was – but also I'm thinking about Danny Goleman, who wrote about emotional intelligence.
Yep.
Where does emotional intelligence begin and something like empathic accuracy, as you call it?
Right.
Are they to be distinguished from each other?
Yeah. Well, empathic accuracy is really one of the pieces of emotional intelligence. And in fact, in a couple of our studies, we used standard, well-validated measures of emotional intelligence. And what's really striking about this is Goleman is saying that emotional intelligence is really one of the most important qualities that a human can cultivate and develop in the self. And we're showing the more you have, the worse you get at emotional intelligence. So something to be thinking about.
Well, I've got to tell you something I've been thinking about in light of all this, Michael Cross, and that's charm. You think about the upper classes and wealthier people as having charm, right? Isn't that a form of supposedly at least showing, some would say it's superficial and all that, but compassion and qualities that we think of as good social interaction?
Right. And I think that it's not that upper class individuals don't have charm or charisma and the like. And I think that there's a lot of other work, I want to say by Frank Flynn over at Stanford, that suggests that people who are really outgoing and extroverted tend to be higher status, and probably higher class individuals have those types of traits. But when you get down to the charitable giving, the really compassionate dependence on other people, you're finding that among less wealthy individuals.
Well, in fact, you've done some new research, I believe, and you can talk about this, that there's more aggression from those in the what we're calling upper class if they more of an assertion of dominance if they're compelled to conceal their status, or if they're compelled somehow to have their social position challenged?
I'm not sure that we haven't done that per se.
I thought you'd been moving in that direction. Maybe I'm
interpolating. We find that lower class individuals, their environments are characterized by increased threat and vulnerabilities. And so when you you can actually flip the compassionate response for lower class individuals when you are in a situation of threat, a lot of times what you see is more anger, more hostility in interactions among lower class individuals.
Yeah, I saw a lot of that in your work, but I thought there was something moving toward research about if upper class, so-called upper class people get toppled from their position or feel they have to defend their position, they become more aggressive. That would make sense, actually.
Yeah, and I think that – and that comes out of the power literature, which is that threats to hierarchies are – or even minor threats to hierarchies are perceived by people in positions of power as it attempts at usurpation. And so you do see this increased aggression as you're talking about. I don't think it's been extended to social class quite yet, but that's a great area of future research.
But what has been extended is this disengagement of behavior with strangers.
Yeah.
Whereas people of less means and so forth, like Blanche DuBois, rely upon the kindness of strangers more.
But in less pathological ways.
Well, where does pathology play into this?
Well, that is actually, Michael, one of the real inspirations for this science that we're doing, which is that in the 1990s and then about 10 years ago, a variety of health researchers were starting to document that pathology and health and sickness is not equally distributed across Americans, that in the lower socioeconomic strata, you find people being more vulnerable to almost every kind of disease, almost every kind of childhood illness like asthma or diabetes, and then also more vulnerable to anxiety and depression. And that really led Michael and I to start to wonder, what is it about the psychology of being low social rank or upper social rank that really produces these vulnerabilities? So it's something to be concerned about.
Well, Michael, I noticed in your work you had a little walking cane cartoon. It brings us back to Veblen and the whole idea of the leisure class. I mean, to some extent, people with means simply have more leisure. They have more time to indulge themselves, I guess, don't they?
Yeah, it seems that way. And I'd actually point out the technological advancements in the last few years. Some of the leisure activities we engage in, the iPad, the smartphone with the email, and these are all things that upper class wealthy individuals have access to. And in many ways, they exacerbate some of the independent behaviors and disengaged behaviors of upper class individuals. You can imagine, for example, my own family, we all have smartphones, and there was on the weekend of my brother's wedding, where we were all sitting next to each other, and mind you, we don't live in the same city. We're all sitting next to each other, really educated people, from middle class backgrounds. We're all on our smartphones, not talking to each other. So you can really see how those sorts of leisure activities pull people away from each other.
There's also the cocoon, I mean, people and we're talking about really affluent people, social clubs, and all of those sorts of things,
right,
that make it. We talk about being in a cocoon in the Bay Area because of the politics here and the culture here and everything, but wealthy people are in their own cocoon, really, for the most part, aren't they?
Yeah, and one of my favorite portrayals of that is somebody who really has influenced us is G. William Domhoff down at UC Santa Cruz, a sociologist who, you know, and it really is surprising for a lot of Americans who are often unaware of the influences and legacies of social class. And what Domhoff portrayed is this very, very complex cocoon that separates the rich from the poor. And it's in the form of nice social clubs and schools and country clubs and social institutions that really sort of set people apart from each other. And it is a form of a cocoon, a comfortable one, though.
Of course, I always say that those people who have the most problems with drugs are the richest and the poorest. Or the children of the richest and the poorest. But there's also a social stigma that has to be brought in for the lower class here. I mean, that plays a role in part of this whole equation.
Enormous. And we so dramatically underappreciate this that, you know, children from lower SES backgrounds, adults from lower SES backgrounds, college students going to elite institutions from lower SES backgrounds, socioeconomic status backgrounds, feel stigmatized because of this, what we've been talking about, which is the lower social rank that accompanies social class. And I think that that's a really important thing for educators to be mindful of and for places for interventions to destigmatize class as other cultures have.
Chris, I can hear some listeners almost thinking, how can we generalize about this? I mean, because there is a whole continuum and it's difficult to generalize. And, you know, there are wealthy people who are very generous and there are poor people who are stingy and horrible. you're really talking about emotional reactions and reactivity to emotions, which is at the core of human behavior.
You know, I think you put it really well, which is that we think of the influences and legacies of social class as affecting the most basic emotional responses, right? As Michael alluded to earlier, what we're learning is that if you come from a lower socioeconomic background and you're dependent on others, it influences all of our emotional reactions to others, how we touch each other, the tone of voice, even things, Michael, that we've been studying in the lab, like, are other people's emotions, do you contagiously feel them? And we're finding lower socioeconomic individuals respond more contagiously to the emotions of others. So it operates at that very basic level.
Well, I think it has a good deal of credibility, maybe even just in my own anecdotal reflection on these things. And I think that also there are many people who come from lower class backgrounds and then move into, let's say, the bourgeoisie or what Mencken appropriately called the bourgeoisie, and suddenly things begin to transform or metamorphose. Some of them still have those insecurities. Some of them become really aggressive, you know, toward like service people. I've seen that kind of behavior, parvenu, nouveau riche, and so forth.
Yeah.
You have to make gradations, I think, when you're talking about upper socioeconomic echelon between the parvenu or nouveau riche, those who become wealthy, and those who have been wealthy for a long time, don't you?
You do. And you know, language always simplifies. And obviously, we have to think about social class on a continuum, which we do scientifically. And the kind of effects that you're anticipating are what we're seeing in the lab. And it's really quite dramatic. You know, Michael's been doing work where all you have to do is have an individual imagine being from a lower background or an upper class background, and you start to see these results we've been talking about, which is if I think of myself, independent of my objective wealth, as being from an upper class background, right, and framing it in that fashion, I become less empathetic, I give less, I'm less generous, I respond with less compassion. So these are pretty powerful immediate effects of class.
I'm going to put out our phone number and invite you, our listeners, to join us. In fact, you can do that now. I know some of you have some certainly questions and comments about what we're discussing here with Dr. Keltner and Michael Krauss. And if you do have some thoughts you'd like to bring into the conversation, please feel free to join us now. It's toll-free, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or a Sirius satellite. The number is 866-733-6786. Again, our toll-free number available to you, 866-733-6786. Feel free to join the program. You can also join the program by email, forum@kqed.org, or post questions or comments on our website simply by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on the segment. Dr. Keltner is professor of psychology, co-founder and faculty director of the Greater Good Science Center at UC Berkeley, and Michael Krauss is a postdoctoral fellow in health psychology at the University of California, San Francisco. And they have collaborated, and they have done, what, 6 or 7 papers you put out on this? Getting a lot of mileage out of it. let's talk about a few more sides of this, though. I remember David Riesman's book years ago I read, and probably both of you know, a famous sociology book about inner-directed people and outer-directed people by a Harvard sociologist. You're using language like solipsistic as the subjective reality of people who are wealthier. Solipsistic to me means, you know, there's no reality outside of my subjective reality. It's pretty self-centered. Michael Krause?
Right. So, you know, taking that idea of solipsism, if you think about that in psychological terms, the only thing we know about others' intentions, others' thoughts, others' motivations really is going to be gleaned from our own experience. So, you know, drawing from that sort of perspective, we think of wealthy context is creating really solipsistic senses of other people. So, you know, understanding others' intentions, others' emotions, in our research anyway, in terms of our own experiences and our own emotional sort of predispositions.
Well, if you're less empathetic, you're more solipsistic. I guess that would be kind of an easy equation. Less charity from the upper class, as we've been calling them, but also less volunteering. Less donation of blood, all those kinds of things?
I don't know about the data on the involuntary, but the contributions to charity, it's unequivocal that you just find across the board.
Well, there's an independent sector study.
Right.
Those under 25,000, I'll just give these facts out because I don't want people to think we're propagating class warfare here. 4.2% income to charity versus 2.7% of those over $100,000.
Yeah, dramatic. And just think about how much more money we would have in the pockets of nonprofits and organizations if we change those ratios. So it's dramatic.
It's dramatic, and yet, of course, you think about people who give millions of dollars because they have billions of dollars, and it seems like a smaller percentage and all that. It's also a big factor in the socioeconomic divide because of healthcare again, because of the fragility of healthcare for those in what we're calling the lower class or lower socioeconomic class.
Absolutely. And you know, we're getting interested in not only the fragility and instability of healthcare, but that is really one of the defining characteristics of the life environments of people from lower socioeconomic backgrounds. It's just unstable work, unstable healthcare, unstable transportation and the like, educational resources. And you if you live in this environment of instability, it's going to have a lot of psychological consequences related to health.
So, well, young people, I mean, notwithstanding the fact that we now have national health care, though this new Congress may try to dismantle it, younger people are going to be more empathic because they're going to have more instability as far as jobs and the economy. At least that seems to be in the reckoning now. So this is bad news and good news, right? More divorce among the so-called lower class, though.
Yeah. Yeah, there is.
What do we make of that?
Well, I think that there are a couple of explanations, and one is, you know, if money difficulties is the second most commonly discussed problem in marriage, well, if you enter into a marriage with more money difficulties, you're going to have more problems. And so that is part of the equation. And then I think the other part of the equation is this instability that we've been talking about, just less stable environments in lower socioeconomic culture, and that makes it hard on a marriage.
Well, if they have more empathy, that would be good for the marriage, though, one would think. But there's the economics that always looms. We're talking to Dacher Keltner, professor of psychology and co-founder and faculty director of the Greater Good Science Center at UC Berkeley, and Michael Krause, postdoctoral fellow in health psychology at University of California, San Francisco. When we return, we'll talk with you, our listeners, and see what you have to say and think about all this or feel about all this as we return after a brief break. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny, and it appears from, well, a number of research papers that have been published and a good deal of research that's been done right here in the Bay Area that upper-class people are worse than their peers at identifying the emotions of other people. That's a new study out of University of California Research. We're finding out about the study this hour, discussing the latest research on emotion and social interaction with Michael Krause, who's a postdoctoral fellow in health psychology at UC San Francisco, and Becker Keltner, who's professor of psychology at UC Berkeley. Let's go to your calls, and we'll begin, Mike, with you. Good morning.
Good morning. I came from kind of a white-collar, somewhat educated background, and in the early 90s got into the building trades, and almost immediately found a level of emotional compassion, just a level of engagement, of personal generosity, just throughout my coworkers, but yet juxtaposed against just a very draconian worldview, not only worldview but kind of societal view. You know, we've got to throw all the illegal immigrants out. You know, welfare mothers are taking all of our tax dollars. You know, our heels are being nipped at from a thousand different sources of people below us who want a piece of what we have. And I've noticed that early on in the building trades, you know, when we were making, I was making $35,000-$40,000 a year. And now on a contemporary basis, surrounded by people that make $150,000-$160,000 a year, I'm kind of in a very niche piece of the electrical industry. And the attitudes, both personal and on a macro level, and this contradiction between the two has been pretty static through my moving up through the income ranks. And it's been kind of an interesting thing to see. I kind of oscillate between friends and people I, you know, date who are academics and professionals and, you know, part of the, you know, so-called smart-ass class or whatever we're calling it now, and then a very, very stereotypical blue-collar mindset, while on the personal level can be very endearing and disarming, and, well, it's a part of me now, and then a very, at least in my eyes, often a very ugly and draconian worldview.
So the political view of those in the building trade that you work with, the blue-collar people, was much more conservative. You use the word draconian, but obviously less compassionate, especially as far as public policy, huh?
Yes, there were all kinds of comments right after, just a week after the Haitian earthquake of, oh, I'm tired of hearing about Haiti, you know, and a quarter million people dead.
Well, maybe the leisure class gives you more ability to be liberal. I mean, so the argument would go, what about politics in all this and your work, Michael Cross?
So I think there's interesting boundary conditions to our effects that need to be explored in future research. I think that Mike's observations are right on, that you know, personally, there's a lot of capacity among less wealthy individuals.
Where most of your research was. Yeah.
Right. For this interpersonal experience of compassionate responses. I think when you think about politics and you think about some of the intergroup competition that can happen for really scarce resources in an unstable environment, it creates this atmosphere of competition for scarce resources in that unstable environment. And that's where you can get some of that competition. You can get working class Americans to really turn their backs on thoughts of economic fairness and wealth redistribution. In that case, when it feels like the wealth redistribution is going to be towards people who don't come from your group of blue-collar workers, maybe are from other individuals who are maybe trying to you know, compete with you for some scarcer resources.
Mike, let me thank you for the call. We'll go to more of your calls. Virginia joins us next. Hi, Virginia.
Hi. I'm trying to piece this together a little, and I came in late to your show, but I grew up, we grew up in really dire situation. I'm Anglo. I was uneducated, undereducated, and I got to a place in my life where I finally got my education. I'm a professional. And I find myself very able to kind of feel into situations and feel into people and be open to how people are and who they are. But because I didn't grow up in a certain area of privilege, I find myself feeling very awkward in groups of people who are working professionals, educated people like I am, but who didn't experience the distress I had as a child. And I don't, I always, this is kind of very personal because I don't know how other people feel. I've never talked with anyone about this. When you move up into, say, social class, out of dire poverty, living on the streets, in homeless shelters, up to a place where you can provide for your family, where do you fit into either place anymore?
Sometimes you don't fit into either one. Now, my own background is not as dramatic as yours, but, you know, it's blue collar. And, you know, I suppose now a suburban bourgeois of sorts, or quasi-bourgeois, as much as I hate to admit it. And there's feelings that, you know, if I'm hanging out with people who are professional and achieve high achievement and all that sort of thing, I like to think I'm comfortable with them. I'm still comfortable with the people from my hood, you know. I mean, that's the way it is. I still have a bifurcated identity, I guess.
Well, that's exactly it. And I think I take that as a confession, Michael. But
it is.
you know, Virginia is speaking to really the complexities of social class and identity that follows. And what we're documenting in our studies is really the life trajectory that she just described, which is this profound sense of empathy that comes out of economic deprivation and concern for others. And at the same time, what she spoke of, which is a sort of this vigilance and this sensitivity to the threatening critical judgments of others that we also document as part of this lower socioeconomic background. So it's a complex identity.
And Virginia, we thank you for the call. And we go next to Maria. Good morning.
Good morning. I am in walking distance to USF, so I went to school there. And before that, I am an immigrant. I am the immigrant generation in my family. And I really resent the American way of putting socioeconomic classes together only on income and education, because there are other considerations. We had no money. I was an immigrant. My husband was an immigrant. Yet we both got an education. I went up to an MA. I have been teaching for many years, and I really, really, somehow or other, never could understand in the classes that I took why it was always money and economics was so much the focal point instead of the intellect. You can be intelligent even if you're poor.
I think Maria raised an important point, and that is, how much is money really the metric to how people judge other people? It gets down to that kind of fundamental question.
Right, and money isn't the whole story, and that's a great point that Maria's bringing up. It's really a context. It's a social environment that's based on, you know, your resources and your access that is captured in part by your income and your education, but it's also the subjective experience of your rank in society relative to others. That's really what's going to drive. So whether or not you have money and education is going to shape your perceptions of whether you're high or low rank, and that's going to then in turn shape how you respond to the environment and how you feel about your environment as being stable or unstable and the like.
And we thank you, Maria, for the call. Let me go to some of your emails. Sean writes, very interesting topics. A couple questions occur to me. First, something Michael alluded to but was not really answered. A person's background has a lot to do with one's parents' wealth and class, i.e. whether a person was raised wealthy or whether they became wealthy. Did this factor into the categorization? And secondly, it doesn't seem entirely fair to compare charitable giving by upper versus lower classes on a percentage of income basis without also making a simple comparison of raw amounts given. How does that compare?
Well, we were sensitive – so I'll answer the second question, I guess, first. We were sensitive to the notion that looking at percentages of income and charitable giving is not a great or maybe not a perfect metric of giving. So what we did was we brought people into the laboratory and we had them help other individuals in the lab. And in that context, that controlled context, everything else is equal. People from lower class backgrounds help more. So they help individuals more. They take on tasks in these experiments so that their distressed experiment partner has to do less in the experiment because they're distressed. So that's the answer to the first question. I'm forgetting the
second. That's the answer to the second question. You took the second question. How much about background? Did you factor that in? I mean, where people come from as opposed to where they are?
So we find a similar effects looking at background, so family, social class background, that we do looking at current social class background. Although I would imagine that there are going to be some really interesting future studies looking at sort of how people ascend or descend the socioeconomic hierarchy and some of the implications of that for behavior. But we don't have research specifically on that yet.
Yeah, you're providing a model here for a lot of further study. Here's another listener, Sarah, who says, I'm interested in the exceptions to the rule. What commonalities have you found among the upper class who are very, very benevolent or the selfish lower class folks? In my family, we have a bit of everything, poor, rich, selfish, generous. I attribute it to personality as much as class. Also, we're a Jewish family, and there's a strong Jewish ethic to repair the world. Those that are more observant in my family tend to be more benevolent. So how does religion play into your work?
Well, I think there are a couple of answers to that, and I think Sarah's really anticipating something very interesting. One is the emergence of particular ethics that drive altruistic behavior, noblesse oblige, and then, you know, with her case, the Jewish tradition of helping the world. And then the second point, and it's actually a very interesting comment on the effects of social class, which is that we're learning that in the upper echelons of society, in terms of power, social rank, or social class, you're allowed to express your individual differences in a stronger sense. Genes are more important. Your individual temperament is more important. And so what Michael and I would predict is that it's the highly altruistic individuals in the upper class backgrounds that give in profound fashion. But that is the exception to the rule.
Faye writes, is your guest joking? If I was at a party or family gathering and all those people were on smartphones, I'd berate them, were I the host, or I'd leave, were I a guest. My fondest gathering moments with friends and families involve conversation, food, and human interaction. Why would adding buying power of class destroy that? I'm on my computer daily. Why go to a social gathering and fall back on the same activity? Either your guest has issues or his friends are stiffs.
That's a fair comment.
Here's John. It says, one assumes that the first marriage of lower class couples occurs at an earlier age than that of higher classes. That could be a significant contributor to the higher divorce rate.
Yep, absolutely.
Listener named Wink says, your guests talk about the lower classes being more empathic than the upper class because the lower class is more economically unstable, interconnectedly involved, and community-oriented. To me, sounds like the lower class is more busybody. How do your guests filter out busybody from their research results? I guess by busybody, just meaning maybe more curiosity.
Concerned about the affairs of others. Seems like I'd praise it. Yeah, and it's an adaptive strategy.
Tim writes, couldn't part of the cause of this effect be a tendency among the wealthy to dismiss most of the rest of the world as essentially wilderness that one needs to protect oneself from? Most without wealth would like to be near those with it to make connections in hopes of gaining opportunity. The wealthy could see those less lucky as unwelcome competitors for their own attention and wealth and routinely wear blinders to those poorer than they so as not to allow them into their own worlds. Another listener, Reba, writes, I went to a top business school and have seen how the impact of shifts in class impact on people as they rise up the business ladder. I find people's emotional intelligence decreases. I know someone who seems to have trained themselves to have a lower emotional intelligence as a result of having to deal with the pressures of management, I think, especially when it comes to taking a harder line with employees or in some cases firing employees. Having a lower EQ seems to be a coping strategy. And I also find people in the lower class especially to be much more empathic, maybe because they've been in very stressful life situations and can more easily relate to people going through other stressful circumstances. They seem much more willing to help their fellow man. Those stressors are very important in your work, Michael Krauss, aren't they?
I think that's a great point. And you can imagine being really successful at an academic institution at your job. There's a lot of emotional work that you could be doing at your job, but that will take away from your productivity, from your intellectual pursuits and the like. And so, you know, sort of dampening that emotional response, that concern for others, especially when it's stressful, when it's tense, can help you focus. And so it could be part of why individuals who are so wealthy are wealthy in that way and successful in that way.
Chris, a lot of this is guesswork and extrapolation.
Sure.
But inference. Let me go to more calls, though. And Ginny joins us from Nashville. Good morning.
Good morning. I am a professional musician, a classical musician, and this is a very interesting topic to me because I grew up in what I would consider an upper middle class, private school, and I went to 8 years of higher education and have 2 post-grad degrees. But because of the state of the arts, I am now financially in a class that's much lower than what I grew up in. But to add to that, in the arts, a lot of our patrons, our donors and our board members, and people we spend a lot of time professionally around, are in the very high echelons of the socioeconomic class. And I just wondered if your guest had any comment on artists and where they have felt that they fall in the class structure.
Well, Dr. Keltner, some thoughts about artists in this whole
schema. Being married to an artist, and my dad was an artist, and having them around me. Well, it's a really interesting observation, and one of the things we were talking about before going on air is Our theorizing would suggest that artists who come out of states of deprivation may be more empathic and may be more attuned to the deeper trends of human nature.
Yeah, talk to those artists who suffered with cockroaches. That's a it's a wonderful romantic notion, but it doesn't
okay.
know. Thank you for the call. Also, deprivation, as we're talking about, socioeconomic deprivation, I think has a lot to do often with drive. I mean, you know, we're a socially mobile culture and you can move up. And moving up has to do with the octane or fuel that you have behind you that may come out of trying to prove something that comes from, well, lower class background often.
Yeah, I mean, that's a terrific observation. And what we would add to that, Michael, is that, you know, thanks to people like Danny Goleman, who we referred to earlier, we know that how well you do in almost any situation or any context, a big piece of that success is this emotional intelligence that really is at its sharpest when you are in a state of deprivation. So it's a good stepping stone.
Well, here's a question for a good psychologist, which you are, Dacher. How does birth order interact with the correlation of social class and compassion or generosity or empathy? I'm particularly interested in learning if the later born, the babies in the family, are more compassionate than wealthy firstborns.
Yes. Well, we should bring your friend and my friend Frank Soloway here and his brilliant book, Born to Rebel. You know, what we know, and it really comes out of a scene.
We should bring Alfred Adler here. Is who we should really – no, sorry.
So Frank Soloway in Born to Rebel that latterborns are more emotionally intelligent. They're more empathic. They're more compassionate for a lot of interesting evolutionary reasons. And I think the sources of that are the same, which is that – occupying positions of lower rank make you just a sharper judge of other people.
It's fascinating, the Soloway study, because at the time, I think every Supreme Court justice was youngest in their family.
Wow. Didn't know that one.
Did you study, one of our listeners writes, the political ideologies of the class groups? And if so, is there a breakdown on donations based upon percentage of income of each group, Libertarian, Republican, Democrat, Independent? We didn't get into any of that, but it might be interesting to kind of speculate about how that affects. I mean, when you're talking about the wealthy, you're often talking about Republicans more than you are Democrats, although a lot of wealthy Democrats. But, I mean, percentage-wise, simply Libertarians and Republicans generally have more money.
Yeah. I mean, one of the strengths of doing laboratory research is we can control for religious ideology and political ideology, and you see independent effects of social class on altruism and generosity. And one of the questions that Michael and I are starting to tackle is how does social class influence your moral ideology, right? And what we're finding is as you rise in the ranks and gain resources, you privilege an ideology of self-interest.
You feel more entitlement.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So
I'm waiting for that study. Lalitha joins us. Hi, Lalitha. You're on.
Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to mention that I work as an equity and justice consultant with independent schools, which are fairly elite and exclusive private K-12 schools. And what I've observed in our upper-class families, and obviously not all of them, is not only this lack of empathy, but an absolute insistence that they are empathetic. So they believe they are very compassionate, very empathetic. And in fact, if they heard about this study, they'd be highly insulted at the notion that they have been found to be, quote unquote, lacking empathy for lower class people. So I wondered if you could comment on that, and I'll take your response off the air.
All right. We thank you for the call. Michael Krauss.
I think that when I talk to people of various backgrounds about our studies, we get from individuals who are more educated, more wealthy, we get a little defensive response usually when we bring these studies up. And so Aletha's observation is consistent with our experience that in many ways people don't know that they're being less empathic and that these upper class contexts create these environments that lead to less empathy and more sort of selfish responding to others. And I guess I would what I typically say to those people is it's not something about your genetics that makes you less empathic. It's really about this context, this individualized context, this motivation to excel individually that sort of takes you away from people. But it's not something about you per se.
Just thinking about two very wealthy philanthropists, both whom I was well acquainted with, in fact, knew quite well, both gone now from the world. But one was exceedingly nice to people, for example, worked under him, to people of all stripes. The other one was incorrigibly mean, even cruel to people who worked under him and people who were of a lower class status than he was. And it's always been fascinating to me how there was this division between them that was so stark and dramatic that it was really phenomenal.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that we're learning, and this relates, your observation, Michael, relates to the question of what is your identity like and what is it, the self like in different class backgrounds. And what we're learning is that wealth and being part of an upper economic strata allows your propensities and your temperament and your personality to express itself in the strongest version possible, right, and polarize as you're describing. So it's interesting.
I've also got a listener, David, who wants to talk about gender. Women compose, as he says, a disproportionately large segment of the underclass. Have you looked at data in terms of gender-based ability to read others' emotions? Well, the subaltern role that women have often played, notwithstanding the feminist movement and all it's done for women, has been a factor in terms of their reading emotions more, isn't it?
It has, but the effects for gender are much smaller than the effects we observe. So there's a small effect where women are better able to read others' emotions, but in the literature it's often an inconsistent finding and a small effect. Our effects are much larger and independent of gender. So we control for gender in our studies and find that independent of that, upper-class individuals are less good at reading emotions.
Lee says there are cultural as well as class factors. Asians, particularly Chinese, tend to be more closely bonded to their in-group than us, but far less bonded to everybody else. This means they're more empathic than ordinary Americans and far less so at the same time, depending on who they're being asked to empathize with.
Yeah, no doubt. And part of our thinking comes out of thinking about cultural identity and ethnicity. But, you know, and it's interesting, I just got back from China in August, and what you're seeing there is this fascinating interaction between sort of the classic collectivist identity that really flourished there, and then the arrival of class, right, and wealth. And we will see those two.
Were you in Shanghai?
No, I wasn't.
Particularly pronounced there. Drew joins us from Millbrae. Hi, Drew.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
I had a question. The discussion seems to treat social class as sort of the independent variable driving empathy or lack of empathy. And I'm wondering if there's anything in the research that might suggest that the causation works the other way. So somehow being less empathetic gives one a competitive advantage in terms of class.
Well, it's a terrific question, and it becomes very important when you think about, for example, health issues, right, where we know that coming from a lower socioeconomic background harms your health, right? Thought about it in that fashion. And there have been longitudinal studies in England that have teased apart causality. And what you tend to find is a lot of these effects that we've been talking about really flow out of social class and don't go in the opposite direction, right? But it's a great question.
And we thank you for that question. And let me go to some more comments from our listeners coming into us by email or on the web. Ramona writes, great show. Thank you. This helps understand why some folks whom I serve at a charity are so profoundly different in attitude. The ones of obvious higher SES are most often offended by tone of voice that is flat and matter of fact. Ask and ask for more. Take more and act as if their actions do not affect anyone else. I'd venture to guess that children whom are abused, neglected, or from alcoholic homes, regardless of class, are more empathic also. Education and understanding are the light. Thank you again. Joe writes, the cocooning of the upper class often begins in childhood with the placing of children in exclusive private schools. As a private tutor, I'm often called upon to advise parents on high school selection, and I often suggest public school precisely because I think exposure to kids from all backgrounds helps privileged kids develop empathy and understanding of the world they live in, which benefits themselves and society. And another listener writes, this is another Joe, I wonder to what extent we, people of different classes, simply act the way we think we are supposed to, just mimics the very ideas that we have known at a cultural level, meaning non-scientific but experiential for as long as we've had class. That is, do we act mean and disconnected because we think that behavior is in itself a symbol of being higher class? And Rosemary says, the research that your guests have found in relationship to the rich does not surprise me. Many years ago, I lived next door to a very hardworking elderly Scottish woman who was very generous herself. In order to survive, she had to supplement her small pension by babysitting and catering to parties for wealthy people in the East Bay. She did not have a business license and had to depend on donation from her customers at the end of the evening. She was often disgusted with how little the wealthy valued her labor. When I asked her why she thought these rich people were so stingy, her response was, why do you think? They're wealthy and I'm poor. Well, like I said, we don't want to incite class warfare here this morning, lest anybody think otherwise. Just reading what's coming in. Judy is joining us from Castro Valley. Hi, Judy.
Oh, hi. It's Kitty, by the way. But thank you, Michael. Really thought-provoking program. And I'm calling, you know, in retrospect, how I raised my kids on the peninsula as a single parent. I was going to graduate school. And so I had Section 8 housing, which allowed us to live in a, you know, a nice community. And but also I was a, you know, single mom, you know, working, going to school. And my kids went to a nice high school. And my daughter said to me not too long ago, she's 20-something, and she said, you know, Mom, I don't know if that was better for us, because I really felt, you know, like the kids had more than I did, and, you know, sort of really, you know, as teenagers will do, compare themselves to each other. And, you know, I thought, wow, here I am. I thought I was doing a great thing, and she's telling me that it, in a way, backfired on her. So I just really wanted to make that comment and see if your guest had anything to say about that.
I'm glad you did. Michael Krause.
So, yeah, our work thinks about class as a rank perception. So you can imagine, and this is our work, but also work by Jen Richardson at Northwestern and Hazel Marcus at Stanford, and that suggests that these environments, you put yourself in an environment that's different from your own class. So you're from a working class background. The environment that you're in, be it an elite institution, a higher education institution that's elite, is going to activate stigma for you. You're going to have this lower identity than a lot of the people that you interact with. And that can be a very stressful sort of experience.
Well, thank you both for bringing this research to the fore here and making this public audience aware of it. And appreciate your being with us. Michael Krause, again, is postdoctoral fellow in health psychology at UC San Francisco. And Thacker Keltner is professor of psychology and co-founder and faculty director of the Greater Good Science Center at UC Berkeley. His new book is Born to Be Good, The Science of a Meaningful Life. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. Thanks to our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and to our producers, Judy Campbell and Kevin Guillory, with production assistance this week from Christina Russo and Pat Yalom. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.